Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
How are things?
Things are good. How are things with you?
Pretty good. It's been 3 weeks since we talked for a secret podcast.
It's been a long time. It seems that's unusual for us.
Yeah, well, I brought in Stephen Hackett 2 weeks ago. I don't know if you heard that. We talked about you.
I've never heard about him. Never heard of
All
him.
All right.
I don't know who that is.
And then last week, you were coming back and I was going and it just didn't happen. So here we are, another week gone by.
But we're reunited.
And it feels okay.
It feels all right. It feels fine.
So today I did a surprising thing. I surprised myself where I wrote a digression about what Charles Arthur wrote about Mark Gurman's story about new AirPods coming. So I guess I should back up and say I linked to a piece on Bloomberg yesterday by Mark Gurman, who has his sources saying that Apple's working on surprise new versions of the AirPods. Like, you know, we would expect. But he had some details. He says that they're going to be able to handle the wake word for Siri, which I'm not going to say, the wake phrase, directly. And that, which somebody said, doesn't it do that now? And it's like, no, but your phone is listening. So if you trigger that and your microphone for your phone is around and can hear your voice, then it will trigger. But this would basically, it would be listening for that wake sound on the AirPods all the time. And so you could just use your voice to trigger it instead of having to double tap or use your phone or whatever. And also that they're trying to add some waterproofing and they're going to have a more robust wireless chip. So those are the details. When I was putting the link story together, I noted once again all of the funny things that they make, that Bloomberg makes Mark Gurman write or that they insert for him in their house style, and how, look, I know people who have worked or do work at Bloomberg. It's a quirky organization. They got lots of quirky things about them. Having a quirky style guide is among them, mm-hmm. but not the only ones. But, you know, it's when he went from 9to5 Mac to Bloomberg, you started to see like the way his stories, they just kind of get inflated with kind of garbage words, I would say, that are there. Like I read these Bloomberg stories by Mark Gurman, and like 80% of it is not content.
Sure,
it's
right.
Structure upon which the four pieces of information are laid, which he didn't have feel the need to do so much of with.
It's a little more informal, right? So it's more of was more of a blog, not a, you know, traditional publisher. So, you know, there's a different format,
exactly.
There's a different tone, all that stuff. I, you know, the copywriting thing made me think of the book by Mary Norris, who is the New Yorker's copy editor, one of them, called Between You and Me, which is a very funny book. But it mentions one of the things I always found peculiar. The New Yorker is one of the few places to use the diuresis over double vowels. So if you see, like,
yes.
Cooperate, it has, like, the two, looks like an umlaut.
Yeah.
And she has a story in there about running into, like, the person in charge of the style guide in the elevator. And she's like, are we going to get rid of this? And he's like, yeah, I'm going to do it next week. And then it's like he died, like, 2 days later. That was 1973. Nobody's mentioned it since then.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, these organizations, they get stuck in their little ways.
On one level, I admire the fact that they have things in their style guide, the New Yorker, that literally no one else in the world has in their style guide. On the other hand, it's incredibly stupid because it's not like, stop. Nobody does that but you. Stop it. It's not part of your, it does mean that you can tell when you're reading the New Yorker, but all it does is make me roll my eyes and think, why am I reading the New Yorker?
Right.
That,
I mean,
to be honest,
the argument at the time was that, like, if there was a, you know, there were words to you wouldn't mistakenly pronounce it as Cooperate, for example.
Yeah.
But
boy,
nobody
has
that problem.
If we got to put diacritical marks on words in English that are hard to pronounce, it's going to look like Turkish, basically. It's going to have diacritical. Boy, I got a whole sidebar about Azerbaijan, I think, switching to the Roman alphabet. And
oh, yes.
How there's a whole controversy about, like, the president wanted it all to be like with apostrophes and stuff, and all the linguists are like, no, Turkmenistan already has a system for this. Our languages are very similar. We should just use their system. It's the same system. And the president's like, no, apostrophes. And then they did that for like a couple of months, and then the president was like, okay, fine.
I used to have a job
to a third set.
Yeah, I used to have a job in a library where you had to like read through transliterated titles into, like, basically, you know, non-Latin characters turned into Latin characters, and there are systems for doing these things, but there are also more than one system, so there's sometimes disagreement in how you transliterate.
My apologies to Azerbaijan. It's Uzbekistan. Mm. Uzbekistan, mm, that I believe is having the transliteration problems as they throw off the Soviet. It's not Uzbekistan. It's Kazakhstan. It's the big one. It's Kazakhstan. That's it. I apologize to all the Stans and all the Johns. Anyway, so that was fascinating because that's like on a national level of like, we're going to throw off the Soviet Cyrillic characters that were given to us. And we're going to go to this other thing that is more like the rest of the Western world. And that's a political statement. And it's also like everybody in publishing has to follow the rules and then the rules change. Anyway, it's fascinating. My point here is that Charles Arthur, who is a great tech writer and he has a newsletter and a blog, and it's also posted on the web called The Overspill. That's like a linked list of stuff every day about tech. And he complained about the writing in the Bloomberg article, and it made me laugh because I see it and roll my eyes at it, but he actually complained about it. And I want to read you one sentence from it that made me laugh and that he quoted in it, which is, "The Cupertino, California-based technology giant, is working on a new version for release as soon as this year with an upgraded wireless chip. The people said," and the point here, what he says, the people is that one of the things I always noticed about it is that first off, he can't say my sources. He says, according to people familiar with the matter,
which we've all heard. I mean, that is a phrase that has become very ingrained, but abbreviating it to just the people sounds people.
It's funny that a lot of news organizations would actually say people familiar with the matter who are not authorized to who's had to speak anonymously because they're not authorized to discuss it because a lot of places now have to, because of a lot of scandals specify like why is this an anonymous source, and, right, and Bloomberg didn't do that here, but still it's funny because then all of the further ones, instead of being like sources say or this is just a fact, they all are almost all it's like according to the people said, which I just makes me laugh. It's so weird. But also Arthur points out the Cupertino based technology giant, as he puts it, in case you were trying to find them on a map, yeah, which it's just trying to vary it and not say Apple or the company every time.
Yep.
But like,
yep,
Cupertino, California dash based technology giant. Yes. I'm reading a story about Apple. I know that it's Apple. Thank you very much.
It's interesting from the variation point, because I remember I used to use just Cupertino as a variation, as many of us do, right? Like, I remember somebody angrily calling me on that probably at some point in the Macworld days, like, well, Cupertino is a city. It's much bigger than Apple. I'm like, yeah, but it's a figure of speech in the same way that we say Washington to refer to decisions made by the U.S. government, or,
right,
Moscow to refer to decisions made by the Russian government, etc. It's a metonym. You were substituting, and they didn't want to hear it. They were very incensed by that usage. I was like, sorry, it's just a way to not say Apple every time.
Yeah, I can see the argument. Although the CIA is often referred to as Langley, right?
Sure.
And yeah, the CIA does not operate, to my knowledge, it could be a great conspiracy, the CIA does not operate the entire city of Langley, Virginia.
There's not much else there. I've driven past it. those are flourishes that writers make sometimes. But yes, needing to specify that we're identifying it by those terms rather than just using it as a substitute is a little bit, stylistically different.
Yeah.
So, and part more of it cumbersome is too.
9to5 Mac doesn't have a style guide, certainly. Sure. So that's part of it, is going from informal to the formality of a giant organization that's trying to impose, this is why organization has style guides, trying to impose some consistency in the writing that they publish. That makes sense. Bloomberg is extra quirky in a lot of ways, including this, but it's not uncommon at all to have this. Their things are kind of quirky, though, which is the thing that puts it over the top for me. Is like, and to see somebody go from a blog to a big news organization like this is where you see it.
Sure.
Is,
yeah,
like, wow, what happened to Mark Gurman? Did he get hit on the head? What did he? And it's like, no, he got fed to the copy desk. That's what happened.
Well,
and
yeah,
copy editors are not just there to fix mistakes, they're also there to impose a house style. And you know, for better or worse, that's the style. But I do like that Arthur, Charles Arthur, is pointing out here that a lot of American news organizations have these rules that, as he says, it's like a weird grammar of its own. Like, this is how you phrase this sort of thing. And he's right. He's right. I think it's not necessarily good or bad. It's just very different from what he's used to in Britain and also on the web.
We had a style guide.
We did
for many years, and I think as time went on, we became a bit looser with it. And I know you made some executive decisions at a couple points with archaic things that were stuck there.
I was going to say that at some point once I was in charge, I tried not to just, like, you know, you got to work with your managing editor. So the last thing you want to do is create a revolt among everybody who's getting your magazine out and copy editing all your stories by decreeing things changing in the rule book. But there were some things where I was like, right, why are we doing this way? And the answer was,
because it's in
the style guide, we could change it. Yeah. That's what I was getting at with the, it's like that with the New Yorker and also with Bloomberg, which is like, these aren't sadistic people who are trying to just mess with the readers and the writers. They are, you know, but what happens is the reason for the rule passes across the time horizon. Nobody remembers it anymore. Right. And it's just because it's a rule that we've always done it this way.
At some point, a decision had to be made, because otherwise you end up with like four different ways of writing website and, you know,
indeed.
At some point, somebody just had to say, like, look, we're just always going to write it this way for consistency's sake. Maybe that's the wrong decision, or maybe that will evolve with time, but it got decided. Nobody went back. Everybody just sort of adhered to it and, you know, never got revisited. So that's fine. I mean, when I went from Mac user to Mac world, even though it's the same organization, the style on Mac user was much more informal and open. And we did not even, I don't think we even adhered to the style guide necessarily, because we were sort of operating on our own recognizance. But yeah, certainly stylistically, going from that to being able to go write like a news story, something that was going to potentially get pushed out, you know, on the wire to other IDG sites, for example, you know, that was a different skill set. It's a very different sort of construction. And, you know, it's not as common, I think, in a lot of places now. I mean, you know, you mentioned Bloomberg's copy editors. Like, I mean, guess we had this discussion in the member Slack, I think, not that long ago, talking about how many places even have copy editors anymore. And the answer is probably not as many of them. Like, yeah, probably a lot fewer. I mean, by the end, we only had like one.
Yeah, a place like Bloomberg, though, I mean, the kind of place where you're going to get the strong copy desk.
Or the Times, the New York Times.
New York Times is a good example. I mean, that's the one that always gets me with the New York Times, of course, is that they, on second reference, refer to everybody with Mr., Miss, Ms., whatever it is. They will give you that declarative on it. So it will be Mr. Morin said, you know.
And places where I think Times also does full names, often with middle initials, like, you know, Timothy J. Cook, or what, I can't remember his middle initial is, but, like, you know, they won't call him Tim. They're not formal with him.
Even if he says, I'm Tim Cook, and it says on his bio, Tim Cook, on the Apple website, they will refer to him as Timothy J. Cook, often like comma 48 or comma 51,
right.
Like with the A, it's like, we got to put an age, we got to put your full name. And again, there are reasons for that, but you know, you also get used to different kinds of writing and you're like, why is that actually that way? And sometimes it's just because it's the New York Times, and we're I had a journalism professor or, you know, teacher in a journalism school who worked for the New York Daily News. He was the city editor of the New York Daily News at one point, and he said the New York Times writes for microfilm. So you can think of that now as like an archival search, but it's like they write for the history books. They write to be the first reference of American history.
Paper record.
And I kind of feel like that's one of the reasons that they say Timothy J. Cook, comma, however old he is. It's like, aha, but now it's down in the history books that this is the Tim Cook we were referring to when we discussed Apple.
And that he was 48 at that point.
Yeah. Apple Incorporated, the Cupertino-based firm, Cupertino, California-based firm. Don't confuse it with other Cupertinos in other places. Anyway, it's silly, but I noticed it, and then Charles Arthur wrote about it, and I was like, all right, that's good. Like, it's not just me. So I tossed it out there. I like Mark Gurman. It's not his fault. It's just, you know, Bloomberg's paying him. It's great, but he gets put through the machine, and I'm a believer that copy editors and style guides need to Well, I don't even want to say need to move with the times, because they do move with the times. They just move slowly. I guess I have for so long been in the role of pushing copy desks and style guides to adopt the new terminology. And I think that that's a function. I feel like that's the natural ecosystem there, is that there are editorial people who push the copy desks and say, we need to update the style guide. And then there's the natural kind of push and pull between them and the it's not even necessarily the people who are trying to stop it. It's just like the style guide resists it. Well, and I think that's healthy.
This is it's a long running thing in language in general, right? Prescriptivism versus descriptivism. Are you the record where this is how people should use language, or are you just documenting how people already use language? And style guide is like, it's like a microcosm of that, right? In this particular circumstance, this is how we are using it. And by nature, they end up being very prescriptive, because it is essentially prescribing this is how you use these terms. But if you go too far wide of the mark, then people start thinking you sound ridiculous, or you're not reflecting the way that things currently get used. So it's a balancing act.
Yep.
Just tuning in, this is Language Talk with Dan.
Well,
Jason.
You know, we use language to write the website.
That's what we do.
What do you want?
we do use language. It's a good way of putting it.
It's true. Sometimes strong language, We have to check the box. So we should probably talk about the HomePod a little bit.
Yeah, we can talk about the HomePod. We both have one.
You wrote about it on Macworld. I've got a couple here. I bought one, and then I got a review unit, so I have two. Right, one still in a box
because you can't stereo pair them right now. Can't do anything with two of them. Yeah, you mentioned somewhere, I think just in a conversation in one of our Slacks or something, is like, yeah, I don't feel like I have a lot to say about the HomePod. And you know what? I have felt in a very similar situation with that, in that it is a device that is exactly kind of what I expected it to be, which is a little disappointing. I mean, it's not to say that it's not, like, you know, a perfectly solid device, but in the back of my head, I had hopes for that this might push the envelope a little bit, and instead it was exactly what I expected it to be. And the reality was a little disappointing, just because you do want Apple devices or any technology devices to feel like, oh, wow, this is even better than I expected. And we've had that experience with Apple devices in particular in the past. But in this one, it kind of hits the mark, which is fine. It's just that mark isn't very ambitious.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, yes, I said that in Slack earlier today, that I didn't think I had much to say about it. And then, of course, that led to a conversation that gave me at least a little bit to say about it. So I will write something about it soon. I was actually playing, right before we started, I was playing music on. I got all of my smart speakers lined up again and tested them out one more time. And it's, yeah, I mean, I'm an Apple Music user, and so being able to use voice control to play Apple Music, it's basically the only option for that, and that's nice. But, like, the question is, for almost twice the price of a Sonos One, because Sonos stuff will play Apple Music, you just can't use your voice control to do it. You can use voice control for, like, I think Amazon and Spotify.
Yep.
But not Apple Music, because they're not able to, like, index the text of the, I don't even know what the reasons are, but they can't do it. Like, basically Alexa doesn't talk to Apple Music and know about it, so it can't control it. And it's Alexa that's embedded in the Sonos One at this point.
And whether that's Amazon or Apple, or just some combination of, you know, no give and take between them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so for me, and this is, you're getting, hey members, you're getting a preview of what I'm going to write. That's what it comes down to me, is like, how much do you want to pay for being able to use a spoken interface for your music instead of an app? Like, that's it. Or vice versa, while using Apple Music, right? Or otherwise, just how much do you want to just pay for a different music service in order for you to do that? Because you can do that on Amazon stuff and through Sonos if you have a different music service that's not Apple Music. But it's a very, you know, we are slicing that, whatever we're slicing, awfully thin at that point, because, like, for me, I, as an Apple Music user, and so we're already in a very narrow case, but, you know, there are a lot of Apple Music users out there. It's like the difference between this and a Sonos one that costs a lot less is literally, do I really get so much out of talking to it that I will use it more than just pulling out my phone and playing music on it that way. And I think the answer for a lot of people is yes, because it's way more fun to tell a device to play music.
Yep.
But the alternative would be save your money, buy a Sonos One, and just pay for, you know, Amazon Music or Spotify instead, or in addition. You lose the personalized stuff. And I mean, you still lose stuff in that scenario, but you're buying a much cheaper product. So I don't know. It's not a bad product.
Yeah.
And it has use cases. It's just, it is what it is. And this is my larger point, which is if the only reason really that you get this over a competing product is that voice control stuff, that means the reason you get this product is Siri.
Right.
And Siri, you know, it's great. The products, microphones and stuff, it's amazing. What it can understand, what it can hear, it's amazing. But then Siri has to interpret it and act on it. And, you know, Siri is kind of a mess. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't work. It behaves in weird ways. And as we were also talking about in one Slack or other this week, its performance is completely inconsistent across devices.
Yes.
So as you pointed out, you know, you can't ask it to do flight information.
Even though that information is there, it just won't.
Even though
it doesn't know how to do that.
It doesn't know how to show it to you or tell you about it.
It's hard to figure out. I was just thinking about this as you were talking about it, and it occurs to me that the difference between something like, you know, the Echo and the HomePod in terms of their approaches to their voice assistants, this is not maybe quite the right analogy, but like there's a very Apple has a very high-minded approach to it. For some reason, the phrase ivory tower popped into my head. Not only because of that is an image frequently associated, I feel like, with the kind of way that Apple portrays itself, but Apple is a very aspirational attempt on their voice assistant, right? Like they've really, I feel like their theoretical aspects of it, like they're really involved in trying to create theoretically what they think is a really good system. It does understand some things really well. It does deal with some complexities really well. And I think on the balance, the Echo, you know, the voice assistant in the Echo might be less well-designed, but it works better. And so at the end of the day, like, it doesn't really matter. It's like a theoretical practical divide to a certain extent. Like, you know, Apple has set out to build this, like, example of, like, their voice assistant. They're like, yes, well, when we're finished, this thing will, like, it will be like talking to a person, right? And so maybe that's what they're shooting for. But in the meantime, it's so rough that Amazon's just like, we're just going to write like a really basic system that responds to like a handful of cues. And it's going to be much more limited, but it's going to be much more usable because what we can, even if we're doing this in a dumb way, it's like writing a program where you like you have like one long like if statement, you know, checking for every single thing, like a text adventure where everything's an if statement and you're just checking for every possible thing that they could be saying versus writing like this really complicated semantic neural network generating system that like can interpret things like a person would. And the answer is it may not matter if the end of the day the other one is dumber but just works better. And I think that's kind of where they are right now. It's like the Echo, you know, there are things I like a lot better about Siri. I actually think, for example, I have mine set to a different voice because, you know, like, by default, all of them have, like, American female voices, which seems like people have written about this before, but, like, kind of weird. So, you know, my Siri on the HomePod is a British gentleman. It's a really nice voice. They've done a lot of work with the speech processing. I think it sounds better than the Echo's voice in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
But yeah, and there are some things that it handles well. It's got very natural cadence and delivers a lot of the information that I, you know, get. And so I've been trying to mix it up and use both and like just compare things. But the capability there is just so much lower. And some of that is Apple has, you know, this is a new device, but it's also that it both is and isn't exactly what we get from Siri on all the other iOS devices, which is to say it doesn't do anything more and it does less in some cases because you can't access your calendar. You can't send, you can't do FaceTime calls or phone calls, it's just weird. It's a strange, and I feel like you can see the rough edges and the kind of things that they may be looking to improve in the future. But in some ways, it's odd that they decided to ship it now, even after a delay, when you're thinking about, well, my immediate thought is, how is this going to change in the future? What updates are they going to roll out to this? It feels very, very basic, very, not even 1.0, but like, you know, it's like a pre 1.0 build sort of.
Yeah. I think the, what's going on, it's, I wonder, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that Apple's approach to voice assistants, and has been since the beginning, is a very Apple user interface, user experience approach, which is, you should talk to it like it's a person. It's going to act like a person. It's going to have personality like a person, and you should talk to it like a person. And we're going to construct this thing so that if you can talk to it like a person, it will do what you say and answer your questions. And that's incredibly hard to do. Mm-hmm. And it feels like what Amazon has done is said, well, what if we make it more, you know, and they wouldn't say it this way, but it's almost like, what if we make it more like the command line, right? What if we make it that if you know the right incantation, you can get it to do things, and people will learn the right incantation? Heck, on the Echo show, it literally keeps a line down at the bottom that keeps rotating, telling you things you should try to say to it. Mm-hmm. So it's like, literally, try to say this thing, and then you will learn to say that thing. And to your point, I think exactly, Apple's ambition to, like, there's got to be a better way, we got to do this better, it needs to be like talking to another person, it's way harder to pull that off. And the net result is that even though Apple, I think, is aspiring maybe higher than Amazon initially, the experience isn't as good for a lot of things now. Also, let's not forget that Siri was designed with phones in mind, and Alexa was designed with no interface other than voice in mind. And that also makes a difference, because Apple has to grapple with the HomePod. Now there's no screen around, which leads to a bunch of situations where it's like, I can't do that. You should go to your iPhone. And that's so frustrating.
And yet it also hijacks when you're trying to do stuff on those devices. If you've got your iPhone lying there and you summon Siri, your HomePod, in my experience, unless the phone is unlocked and I'm holding it, and like, even then, not 100%, but yeah.
It needs to know that you're actively using your watch or your phone or something like that, or the HomePod will intercept the command.
Which is frustrating.
Although I've heard from people who are frustrated that the other things get triggered instead of the HomePod too. So
I had
it works both ways.
I had one the other day where something clearly just got into a glitch, and both the iPhone and HomePod were responding to me with the same queries. And that was very problematic. I had to restart my phone to get it to stop doing that. I think Apple's ambitions are clear. What is less clear to me is how much they're doing with this actively, because, and this is the case with all these tech companies, but, you know, we don't see stuff in the interim, right? Like, Amazon is a weird exception in here, because, you know, I get an email every week telling me here's the new things you can do with your Echo, which is interesting. Whereas Apple rolls out improvements to Siri, even though it's on a server-based backend, and you'll notice stuff change from time to time as they tweak stuff, like in the way that not only just like new responses, but for a while, for example, like it would not repeat back to me. Like, I play this song and it would just start playing that song. Like, it wouldn't say like, okay, I'm going to play you this song now. And then it started doing that again. Apple's not transparent about the changes it's making or new capabilities that it's bringing out, right? Like, that's why you end up with people posting on Twitter like, oh, hey, I just tried asking Siri this thing and it gave me this response.
Well, they added podcasts and it was very much like, oh, it can play podcasts and sync with the podcast app now. Like, that just happened recently, I think, because of HomePod, but it's on the iPhone now too, and it didn't used to do that, and now it does that. And that's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I'm glad the HomePod exists. I think it's a place Apple needs to be, which is why, you know, we've been writing things about this category for years now, and I'm glad that Apple is here. But, you know, this is a start, not a finish, and I hope it is, right? I mean, that's the other thing that fills me with a little worry, because you said, like, it feels like maybe not even a 1.0 product, because the first thing your mind goes to when you get it is all the things that it should do that it doesn't do.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that might be the definition of a 1.0 product, but the point is, like, they're behind in a lot of areas, and I'm concerned about their commitment to this category, because shipping this is the start of a process for Apple to make a better product and other products in this category,
right?
Not the end of a process. And my fear is that Apple will see this as the end of a process and that this product will just kind of float out there. And, you know, I hope that's not true. And I hope that, you know, I hope that Siri gets a lot better and that they're working really hard on that. But the problem is I have hoped that for years.
Right. Right. And with the phone, like if they just sort of dialed back what they were doing on Siri, you'd be like, well, I still have a phone. It still does a lot of stuff. Like, I don't really think about using Siri because it's not as full features I want. But, like, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't really prevent me from doing all the other things I do because I'm generally, like, using the touchscreen when I'm using the phone. On this, on the HomePod, if they don't continue to improve Siri, there's basically no other way. It's just an AirPlay speaker at that point, right? Like, if they kind of seed that ground on this device where Siri is the primary mechanism for using it, this device becomes inordinately less useful. And so I'm totally with you on that. Like, hopefully this is a line in the sand, kind of putting your money where your mouth is thing, because now they have a product, like a hardware product, which is where they like to make their money, that depends on this interface, right? Like, the iPhone did not depend on Siri. That was never a key part, even now it's not. But the HomePod really does. And I think you're right that this is the big question is, are they committed to this or do they think this is good enough? And, you know, we'll add a couple things here and there, but like, it's not a big deal to us. And that's kind of maybe that's like the Apple TV route, right? Where it's like, yeah, every once in a while we'll add new stuff. But like, we basically think this is good enough. And it's always hard to tell whether these are things that these people actually use. And it's just like if people inside Apple are using these things and thinking like, oh, it does everything I want to do because I don't do that much, or they just don't use them.
I don't know. Apple's ways are mysterious, Dan.
They are. They're very mysterious. But part of me wants to believe that because they invested the time in, like, they put a whole like A-level processor in this thing. Like, that's a lot of power in there. Part of me would like to think that they have plans, but you know, maybe they just really, you know, maybe they need someone in there who is a real champion for the HomePod. I'm not sure who that is, but we'll see when they next discuss it, whether or not there's somebody there who seems really excited about the future of HomePod, like in the way that you get like Kevin Lynch out there talking about the Apple Watch. And it's clear, right? Like, he uses the Apple Watch and he's really invested in that.
And I know that there are probably people who are like, well, of course Apple cares about the HomePod. They're hyping it and they're selling it and all that. It's like, well, it shows that they cared at some point, but, you know, they're not going to... The question is, Apple does sometimes put things out there in the world and then kind of walk away for a long time and think, well, we did that. Great job. We're going to move on to other things. And the danger there is when the people in charge of the product ship it thinking it's awesome and couldn't be better, when the reality is that it needs to be a lot better. Because they aren't moving in the right direction in terms of, like, I want the attitude to be, even behind the scenes, right? We don't get to see the behind the scenes, but I want the attitude behind the scenes to be, oh boy, we got a lot of work to do here. This is going to be a couple of years where we're going to put a lot of investment into making this good. And again, they're never going to express that publicly, which is why we have to just sort of like hope. But like, Apple Watch is a great idea or a great example where they came out with the Apple Watch, and yeah, it's very hyped and look what you can do. But it was very clear from everybody. It was like, wow, some of this stuff doesn't work and it doesn't make sense. And the next year they were like, hey, we changed a lot of things that didn't make sense. Like, yes, yes. Good, good, good. Right. They were working on it. They were on it. And I think that the Apple Watch is actually a great example of a platform that not that it doesn't have lots of issues, but like fundamental things about it that they did 180 degrees on. Yep. Because they're like, oh, that button shouldn't be for that stupid circle thing that right. Nobody cares about and uses. We're going to use it for something else. And we knew that the day of, like, nope, that button is dumb. That is not going to do it. But the fact is, obviously, people behind the scenes are like, oh, yeah, that's not good. We're going to have to fix that later. So I hope that's happening with the HomePod because it's a, right. I think there's right. a lot to be done here. And I think it could be a much better product with a lot of Siri improvement that doesn't require hardware improvement. Because it's a good speaker. But it's not like I've got the Echo Show, which adds this video component that's actually kind of nice in certain circumstances, although I talk about products that haven't been improved since they were released.
Right.
The Echo Show is the same damn thing with all of the limitations that they had when it was released. But there are things about it I like. But even if I had just the canister Echo, I don't think I would replace it. I think I'm going to leave a HomePod permanently placed somewhere in my living room so that we can play music on it instead of the Echo, because it does sound better than the Echo. Echo, but that's probably it. I'm not close to a point where I would consider just swapping out an Echo for a HomePod.
Exactly. I'm at the same place, and I'm in my office, which has the Echo Show and a Sonos Play One. And because I'm an Amazon Music subscriber, I'm still playing the bulk of my music on the Sonos just because of the voice interaction there. And I don't have Apple Music. I have iTunes Match. So if I have a song I know is in my library, I can play it on the HomePod, or I can start using AirPlay and using the Amazon Music app or what have you. But yeah, it's not at the point where I would put this in. Our main Echo is in the kitchen because that's where we end up using it the most. And there's no way. I mean, simple things like the lack of multiple timers, that they can't. We use our Echo all the time when we're cooking and we need to set multiple timers for things. And there's no way we would replace the home, you know, put the HomePod in there instead. So, it's not there yet. And it's a question of whether that's where they want to go with it. There's a lot more it could do. Apple just has to show that they want it.
Yeah. So I think we said this about the Mac, but I'm going to say it here too. Because of Apple secrecy, what we have to do is wait and hope that we see incremental improvement or change over time. And literally, we're going to wrap it up for this podcast by bringing it all the way back to style guides and copy editors and things you shouldn't ever do. One of the things you shouldn't ever do is start a story with a Webster's dictionary defines something as something. Well, you also don't end it with this phrase, but I'm going to do it now, which, because when it comes to the HomePod, only time will tell. That's it, everybody. Goodbye. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.